Welcome back to Farewell. I'm your host, Clay Skipper, joined by Steve Magnus and Brad Stahlberg. We are in the throes of March Madness, which begs the question, how are your brackets doing, fellas? We got any busted brackets yet? I know Houston made it to the Sweet 16, Steve, so you should be golden.
Houston's going all the way. That's the only part that matters in my bracket. Nothing else does, and we're on track. So I'm feeling good.
I don't fill out a bracket anymore. I just get disappointed because my brackets always suck. I would rather just enjoy great basketball and root for good games. But go Tar Heels, Tar Heel Blue now.
Well, here's the deal. You know, for 9 years when I was a college coach, they had all these signs posted all over the Athletic thing that said, nobody fill out a bracket because NCAA rules, even the ones where you can't win anything or win a prize if you're the one in a billion who gets it all right, no brackets. So, you know, for 9 years of my life, there were no brackets. I didn't want to break those rules, even though probably every basketball team was breaking the rules, recruiting players, but that didn't matter. So I didn't fill out any brackets. So
I was just going to say, man, keep talking about keeping the main thing the main thing.
Now that
the cross-country coach can't fill out a bracket, but the basketball program can pay everyone for the booster club.
Yeah. That's true. That's right, because, you know, that big scandal with the shoe companies went down while I was coaching. So, you know, I play by the rules, Brad. No bracket for me. So now I'm in the game for the last, you know, couple of years. It's bracket time.
I bring up March Madness because that is pretty related to what we're going to be talking about today, which is last week there at the beginning of the women's NCAA tournament, there was a piece published on ESPN.com by Wright Thompson, who I think we are all fans of. I know him pretty well, good friend of mine. And he wrote a piece about Caitlin Clark, who is, I think it's fair to say, the best women's college basketball player. There might be some people who take exception with that. Angel Reese is probably up there as well. Juju Watkins is a pretty phenomenal freshman player. But Caitlin Clark she plays in Iowa, and she broke the record this year for most points ever scored in college basketball. And she also plays in a way that's just electrifying, similar to Steph Curry. She shoots from the logo, and she shoots threes from downtown, and she'll from deep downtown, and she'll hit seven in a row. And she just is kind of like always on a hot streak. And so always heat checking herself. And anyway, this story by Wright is a long read. I think it said 68 minutes, according to my Insta paper, but it's all about traces Caitlin's arc from a high school phenom through her fourth year at Iowa and leading up to the NCAA tournament, where Iowa, as of this recording, won their first game and are playing in their second round game today. And the reason I think we want to discuss it is we talk a lot on this podcast about principles of how you achieve and sustain excellence. And I think another word for excellence would be greatness. And Caitlin is someone who is very much living that right now. And if you guys read the piece, you don't have to have read it to enjoy this discussion, because we'll break it down for you. But you'll see that she's having to contend and deal with a lot of the things that we discuss and that we often try to figure out what is the optimal way. So it talks a lot in there about how she had to learn to be a better teammate and how she's learning to find peace in the process of becoming great rather than the trophies and the championships. So she obviously wants those too. And that's, you know, how is she balancing that? How is she balancing becoming the greatest player, hopefully ever, in women's basketball, is what she wants to be, with having a somewhat normal life and like being able to have friendships and be a college kid. And so we talk about these things often in the abstract, but this is like Caitlin's life, and Wright did such an incredible job embedding with her and breaking it down that we really get a sense of like how these play out in the petri dish that is Caitlin Clark's life as she's trying to become the greatest women's basketball player of all time, and has arguably become the greatest women's college basketball player of all time. So I think the overarching question for me, I know you guys, we've all pulled out things that we want to talk about and highlights. But the question for me, and the question, it's a question at a lot of the heart of a lot of Wright stories, which is like, what is the cost of greatness? right? And how can we achieve greatness in a way that is allows us to still be healthy and well, but still allows us to like strive for all our highest and grandest ambitions. And if anyone's listening to this and thinking this doesn't apply to me, I think it does apply to you, because I think about this. I'm never going to be a Caitlin Clark, I don't think, or in any way, shape, or form, but I have things I want to do. And I'm often trying to toe that line of like, when do I push? When do I try to be great? And how does that intersect with all the things that can kind of like lead to my healthy lifestyle, like having balance, having friends, having family, having a well-rounded life, but can sometimes take away from the striving for greatness.
I think what you hit is there's the cost of greatness to it that I think is important. And then I'd also throw in there, which I think is the contrast of competitiveness, which means throughout this piece, there's also this like, how do I balance out opposing forces? How do I keep the thing that makes me really freaking good without it destroying me? And I think that thread is also ties into the cost of greatness, but like, this is the thread of achieving or like being really good at anything. I mean, in the piece, what do we see? We see Caitlin having this incredible drive, this fire, this almost anger, which could be productive, right? Allows her to go on streaks and get on hot streaks and take over games, but it can also be destructive, meaning takes her out of that zone, hurts relationships with, you know, her teammates. We have this idea of like competitiveness as well, where it's like compete, this crazy drive to win the thing, to make the final four, to do all this thing. But at the same point, if the outcome is all we're focused on, as is mentioned in the piece, like it can tear us apart. So I think there's to me, it's like those two threads that are really interesting here. And I think Brad has a third thread.
Right, I Brad, think the third thread to interject is she's a 18 to 22 year old young woman as all this is unfolding. That's pretty young. I think they say like our prefrontal cortices don't fully form until we're 25. So it's a time when you're still developing an identity, a sense of who you are, your social group. And to do that while also being on the world stage in the public eye in a way that no college basketball player has been since, I don't know, Christian Laettner, maybe Michael Jordan. You guys,
it feels like Johnny Manziel basketball is like almost a better comparison here.
Yeah, but for sticking to basketball, like I was young when Jordan was in college. I don't even know if I was born, right? It was like 84, right around the time that I was born, Jordan was in college. So I wasn't there, but like I can't think of another college basketball player who had this level of attention on them. I just wrote down like three threads. I wrote down 18 to 22 year old. I wrote down turn it off versus turn it on. And I wrote down the cost of greatness.
I think the other interesting thing here is to combine what you said about her being 18 to 22 with what Steve was saying about the sort of competitive fire. I think it is also interesting that she's 18 to 22. And I think, you know, when you paint broad strokes, they're obviously anomalies, but I think we probably think of the younger generation as sort of learning from to be more balanced, right? Like learning from the stories of Tigers and the stories of Bob Knight and like Steve shaking his head. But I think we would think, oh, they're a little bit more balanced. And so I think what surprised me was reading this in light of some of the things we talk about and being like, oh shit, like Caitlin Clark's court's like a killer. And maybe that shouldn't be surprising, but a killer in like the Kobe sense rather than like the joyful killer in the Steph sense. And to me, honestly, the reason I want to talk about this is it kind of feels like it goes against some of the things we say. And I know the piece has an arc and it shakes out at a little bit more of a peaceful Zen spot, but that was sort of, I was like, oh damn, maybe we're wrong. Steve is like dying to talk. Go, Steve.
I think we get Kobe completely wrong, to use his example. I think we get them completely wrong. I think this is what we often do with like these people like Caitlin Clark, Kobe Bryant, et cetera, who have this relentless drive. And we've known this for a long time, but like, let's use Kobe as a counter example. There was a wonderful interview before obviously he passed away tragically, where Kobe was asked like, what kind of player are you? Are you the kind that like hates to lose or the one to love that loves to win? And Bryant gave this kind of unique Kobe-esque answer. He said, neither. He said, I play to figure things out, to learn something. Okay. What is that? That's not like this egotistical or like killer. That is mastery. That is competitiveness based on what we call self-development competitiveness, not hyper-competitiveness. There is another interview piece that I love from Bryant, where he's asked, what do all the greats have in common? Like all the greats. And his answer, is it's love. And it's pure love. It's not fame. It's not the money. It's not even the championships. It's love of the pursuit, love of the game. And like, I think that we see Kobe's persona, his ability to flip that switch to go into Black Mamba mode, right? And we forget that underlying it is all the stuff that we talk about. And I think that's that heart of this piece as well, is that she's kind of having to learn that, like, yeah, underlying this, you need what Bryant figured out.
I think it would be worth bringing in some actual quotes from the story here, that, and then I want to kick it to you, Brad, because I have a question for you. But so these are two selections I pulled out, and I know, Brad, you also pulled one of these out. But first, here's one, and it says, Caitlin needed help with the chaos of living in multiple dimensions of time, juggling past, present, and future all at once, with tomorrow offering a second chance, but also arrows from the battlement walls. She says, quote, I'm almost playing this game because I have this expectation of all I want to accomplish, but I'm missing the moments in between. I've got to find peace in my life. So that came early in the piece. And that was kind of like deflating. It's just like, oh, you have this unbelievable talent, and she is, what stands out to her, the moments that she's missing because she just is feeling this longing and striving so intensely. Later in the piece, some great writing from Wright here. He writes, internal motivation to be the best and external motivations to reach records and milestones to win, to earn praise and approval overlapped for Caitlin, each one feeding the other. She trapped herself in a perpetual state of chasing where achievements brought no peace. Her coaches and mentors helped her see the lie in those dreams. The numbers, great as they were, fun as they have been to chase, weren't speaking to her soul, weren't why she played. The encouragement and praise from fans, coaches, teammates, friends, and her parents were a sign she was doing something at a very high level, but were never enough for her to feel as if she had arrived. You just want more of it, she said. Then there's a continued quote from her. That's not going to make me feel full at the end of the day. In 20 years, banners and rings just collect dust. It's more than memories. Caitlin settled on a mantra, find peace in the quest. So obviously this is something we have talked about a ton, have a process mindset rather than an outcome mindset. But I guess where I'm curious, Brad, and like any good piece, this raises more questions than it does give answers. So there's no obvious answer. But I'm curious if you felt like at the end of the story, she had got to a place where she found peace in the quest.
I don't know the answer. I don't think Wright knows the answer. I don't think Caitlin knows the answer. I think that now she can live the question.
Yeah.
And I think that is the power of it. Like, you can be aware of this and you can wrestle with it. And my guess is there will be many times in Caitlin's career where she feels no peace, and she gets pulled by the roller coaster of those internal motivations to be the best and external validation. And there will be times when she does find peace. And hopefully she has good people around her that can help her and support her. And hopefully that she gains this awareness that can help her do things to find peace. Another thing that I noted from the piece is, shortly after Caitlin Clark and the Hawkeyes lost to LSU in last year's tournament, they all went out to dinner at a restaurant by the stadium, and they were crying. They were sad. It was really emotional. They just lost. And someone offered to buy shots for the team. And Caitlin Clark and her teammate said 22. And that's Caitlin Clark's number. And soon a tray showed up with 22 shots on it. Wright Thompson writes, that night may end up being Caitlin's favorite memory from college. This group of women truly loved one another, and for the rest of their lives, when they looked at their final four rings or came to some anniversary and saw the banner hanging in the rafters, it is this love that they would remember. In evenings like the one in Dallas, after they lost the biggest games of their lives but still had one another. And initially, she had told Wright, don't write about the night after we lost because it's such a sad, depressing night. And then they go out to this bar and she realizes, like, these are my people. And that's the value. And I think that is ultimately the biggest buffer against emptiness of the pursuit. And it sounds so cliche, but there's all sorts of research that shows that on people's deathbeds, even the most accomplished people, they don't reflect on winning the medal or getting the promotion. They reflect on the people that they did it with. So striving for greatness is about winning, but it's really about what you learn along the way and the people that you do it with. And in that moment, I think Caitlin Clark got a glimpse of that. It's also the kind of thing that you have to remember 150 times in your life because it's so, so easy to forget.
Yeah. I mean, my immediate reaction to that, and like, it's a little bit cynical, but I'm just like, but that's not like, she's great. Cause she's a killer like that. I mean, she might realize that, but I feel like the intern, I don't know. I'm just like,
that's, but I think you have to be able to turn it off and turn it on. And if you can flip the switch to be a killer,
it's one of Steve's threads. Yeah.
Then you turn it on. And if you can then like, and you never completely turn it off, but you have to turn it off just enough to be a functional human being.
And we know this, like there's research, you know, I'll go to the science, but if you look at clutch states, what's one of the number one determiners of being clutch is the ability to flip the switch. Mm. So it's literally in the research, the decision to flip the switch. Okay. And that's what it is. And the greats like cultivate that ability, but there's also research that shows broader than sport, applying to everyone, in terms of high performers, is that part of what gives resilience is the ability to turn it off. So it's not having the stress or the pressure or whatever it is linger. And in the brain, there's research that shows literally turning off like the thing related to the stress response is related to resilience. So we don't all do it perfectly. And the other part I'd give you is, again, I talked about self-development competitiveness. The complete contrast to that is hyper-competitiveness. Mm. And what research shows us is that hyper-competitiveness is what? It's when we attach external validation to the thing, and then we can never freaking turn it off. Meaning that, you know, Clay, when you go play your, I don't know, 5-year-old niece at Go Fish, like you're playing to win instead of being like, you know what, like maybe I'll give some points. You know, when we all came together and played basketball with Brad's kid, like, you know, we played him a little tough once we realized he had some skills.
I knocked him down twice.
You know, you knocked him down twice, right? But you didn't get in his face and push him down all the time, you know?
Not while you guys were watching.
There's a degree. You can turn it on and off to a degree. And I think, yeah, there's exceptions. But generally, what you see is that, you know, that killer instinct. Again, it's Kobe. It's the Black Mamba. Like, switch it on and off. And when we don't, when we can't turn off, generally bad things happen. I mean, you brought up Johnny Manziel. When he became Johnny Football, we're great on the field. But when he carried that out to the off the field, guess what? It didn't work very well.
Yeah.
Couldn't turn it off. You know, he wanted to be the guy who was having fun, who was like the life of the party, the person everyone went to. When he was the quarterback of the team, worked well. When he was, you know, drinking beers in College Station, not so much. Yeah. So like it's really hard. And I think this is what makes it hard, especially at the highest level, is it's like playing with this nuance of the thing that makes you great, that killer instinct. If you let it go too far, like it can freaking ruin you.
I was just going to pull out another quote, which is, it gets at this tension. I mean, it's not so much about the sort of on-court killer versus the off-court persona, though it certainly relates to that, I think, but it's more about, to Brad's point, of how she's just 18. This is the story that traces her from 18 to 22, and she's this unbelievably public figure, and talking about the fame she has to deal with. And again, some more great writing by Wright. He says, modern fame is a radioactive thing that corrodes everything it touches and consumes some people completely. And then writing about Caitlin, he says, she worked hard to get better, to relearn the lessons of the past, which seemed like new problems because of her new and growing fame and the expectations that came with it, both the external ones put on her by the world and the internal ones put on her by herself. There's a John Updike quote I love about the mask eating the face that seemed to apply to what Caitlin was experiencing. The Iowa coaches were hyper aware of that possibility that the famous Caitlin Clark would swallow the goofy girl they'd known, and they believed at the end that they'd all mostly succeeded. Caitlin had managed to protect her, her real self. So this is a little different because it's talking about fame, but it's the same idea of like, how do you have the on switch and the off switch, not just for your on-court basketball abilities, but the sort of public persona on top of that. And that's a whole nother level of greatness, but relates to identity and how we always talk about, Brad uses that great metaphor of having different rooms in your house and learning how to be in those different rooms at different times.
I love you pulled that quote, Clay, because I didn't even remember it from the piece, but it tracks so elegantly to what I was going to say.
Great.
Which is, it's going to seem at first like a crazy connection, but it's a little bit like watching the Martin Scorsese documentary on Bob Dylan, which traces Bob Dylan on the Rolling Thunder review tour. And Dylan, at that young age, early in his career, was such an insanely intense performer. Like, watching Dylan play a show is beyond mesmerizing. He is trembling up there on stage. And what did Dylan do on that tour? I'm just figuring out, maybe that's why. He painted his face in Japanese kabuki. So every night when he played the show, he had a white clown face on. And then every night after the show, he took that mask off. And it's like he had to wear that mask to be able to go on the stage and do that. And then the other thing about Dylan is that Dylan doesn't do interviews. Like, he's famously known. It was like the Nobel, I think, that he won, and he didn't go collect the prize because he's like, what do I need this fame for? And a lot of people think that that's just Dylan being Dylan. And there's like an elitistness to that. But I watched some of these interviews because Dylan did interviews with Scorsese, very few because he respects him. And I actually think Dylan's just protecting himself. And I think part of what has allowed Dylan to make such incredible music, even now he puts out stuff. Bob Dylan can say anything and make it sound like it's poetry from God. And I think part of the reason for that is because he has just insulated himself and stayed focused on the craft. Now, I don't know if Dylan's a good hang or not. I don't know anything about him other than as a songwriter. I mean, he's as good as it gets. But maybe it's not just Dylan being Dylan, and maybe it's not this elitist thing. Maybe it's a decision to save himself from that corrosive nature of fame that just gobbles up everything that it touches.
I mean, you've kind of hit on the opposite of the Johnny Manziel, which is like a good persona. Meaning, like, you've almost created like two kind of identities or masks to protect one identity when you perform, which insulates like your kind of real self. It reminds me of, I think it was Aaron Judge who said essentially, like, when I go on the field, I'm 99. When I step off the field, I'm Aaron. And I think it comes down to this, again, identity thing. Why? Because when you're that freaking famous, when you're like, have everybody in the world telling you X, Y, and Z, especially when you're 18 to 22, when you're supposed to be like dabbling and exploring identities and seeing what fits and, you know, discarding what doesn't fit. Like, research tells us we get in what they call identity foreclosure, which means like, because the fame hits us, we just like cement it, right? There's a great Taylor Swift quote. Again, I forget it, but it's from her documentary Miss Americana, where she essentially says, you know, whenever you became famous, you stop at that age. So if it's 17, you're like, see the world through that lens for the rest of your life, because you stop growing, because you just kind of hit that identity foreclosure. And I think what we're getting at here with Caitlin Clark, that quote just perfectly summarizes, is that when you go down that identity foreclosure, which is tempting, I gotta say, not that I was ever at anywhere close to her level, but when you experience like that your temptation is to do that identity foreclosure. Why? Because you get known for the thing. You think that the work, the thing that is making you really good, is like being serious and doing the work and going into that competitiveness. And if you go too far, you burn yourself. And what happens is, like, you double down on that, especially if you struggle, but you double down on that and you lose the other part of you, that goofy kid or the joy or experience. And, you know, I remember in my own career, like in high school, I had a good balance of this for the most part, but then I thought, oh, I got to work harder. And then I like stopped even more so of doing the goofy stuff with friends and teammates and stuff that like kind of took the edge off of performing at a high level, because again, you think, I got to outwork everybody. I got to be more serious. I got to be more committed. And that's what gets in the way.
All right, I'm calling a timeout here. And let me play devil's advocate, or not even devil's advocate. Let me ask a question to, I'll start with Clay, because Steve, you've been talking, and then we'll go to you, Steve. So this makes a ton of sense for the things that you know best, Steve, running and now writing, because you can only run so much before your body just gives out. And you can only write so much before there's such diminishing margin of returns and everything turns to mush. You can only write for so long. I've never been a great athlete. I think I'm a pretty good writer. I can't write for more than 4 or 5 hours in a day. In those days where I catch fire and maybe I go for 6, I can't do that for more than a couple days a year, right? So I have a natural limit. Basketball, there's no natural limit. You can practice. You can watch film. You can get recovery work done that actually does bend the needle at that level. And I want to bring up another quote that dropped last week from basketball that was hot on the Growth Equation group text message, which is LeBron James and JJ Redick. They've got this new show called Mind the Game.
I have that quote. I'll play it right here. I'll play it right here for the good people.
Discipline. You know what? People use that word so loosely.
What does it mean to you?
You have to have the ability, when it comes to discipline, it's like you have to sacrifice loved ones. You have to sacrifice loved ones for a long period of time if you want to be great. It is very unfortunate, and you feel it at times. You know the saying, if it's too hot, get the hell out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to get out of the kitchen because it gets hot. But you have to have a discipline to sometimes you have to sacrifice loved ones in order to be great because they don't understand. And that's okay. They don't understand what it means to, like, I am getting up every single day at 5 or 6 a.m. And when I get home after everyone leaves the gym, I'm going to take a nap. So now you're sacrificing your loved ones because you're not spending time with them. And when I wake up, I'm probably going to train again, and then I'm going to have dinner, and then I'm going to bed. And I'm going to do that every single day for a long period of time.
Better to hear it from LeBron's mouth, not mine. But you just heard what LeBron said. So, yeah, in writing, you can't sacrifice loved ones to be great because you can only write 6 hours a day before your brain explodes. In running, you can't sacrifice loved ones to be great because if you run more than 120 miles a week, your bones are going to break. But maybe we're just too narrow-minded, and maybe to be the forget having a best-selling book, Steve, or being an All-American in college, to be the best in the world in a multifaceted, complex sport, we talk about trade-offs all the time, but do we under-index on truly the extreme trade-offs that need to be made? And you're shaking your head, Steve, but go ahead first, Clay.
Well, I lean towards yes. I think you have to sort of be unbalanced to be great. And certainly there are moments where LeBron has probably had to step back in the offseason. So, and he does have balance. And so maybe it's that sort of theory where on a longer trajectory, you do have balance, but in acute moments, you don't.
Yeah, but, and I don't think any of us are saying you need to be balanced, Clay.
No, but we don't.
We've written countlessly that balance is a terrible goal to strive for.
Yes.
But to me, this isn't about balance. This is about obsession.
Yes.
But even there, I want to parse because Steve and I spent so much time unpacking. So there's like the psychological term obsession, which is tied to intrusive thoughts and unethical behavior and cheating. And I don't think LeBron is having intrusive thoughts about basketball. There's then the obsession, which is this is the only thing that I can think about, and it's really all that I care about, and I'm willing to miss everything else in my life so that I can practice more basketball. That's the kind of obsession that LeBron's talking to. But I also think it's the kind of thing that we like to lionize, because I haven't done the reporting. Like, was LeBron there for the birth of his kids? He certainly seems to be on the sidelines at a lot of Bronny's games, his son. So I think some of this could just be like, it's easy when you've got a bourbon or a glass of wine, whatever him and JJ are drinking in you, to be like the good old boys and, oh, you got to sacrifice because it sounds heroic. But LeBron's been with the same woman since he came into the NBA. He's got the kids. Like, I don't know. Maybe LeBron isn't as crazy as he thinks he is.
Yeah, I don't know. I still think you have to have, you at least have to have, I do think you have to lean towards somewhat unhealthily obsessed. And I think you at least have to have a period, a significant period of your life, like 5 to 10 years, where you're definitely out of whack.
I think you're right, Clay, Brad. Like, there's no escaping the like borderline obsession, right? It's, we need what psychologist Ellen Winter said on Prodigies, like the rage to master, right? It's got to be there. It's got to be. But I think where we get things wrong is often we see it as like totally romanticized and like all the way to one extreme, as if that's what it takes. And I don't think it is. The other thing I'd say there is like the LeBron quote, which is great. But I think it's how you frame sacrifices, because like everybody does, you know, the teacher who works, you know, the teacher probably spends, again, who knows, but less time with their kids than maybe LeBron, because like they got to be at school from 7 a.m. until after tutoring, and then they come home and got to do all their lesson plans and barely see their kids. So, you know, do we lionize that and say, oh, this is an obsession that makes them great? It's like, no, that's their job. And I think the thing is, there's always sacrifices. I think people understand that, like, intuitively. You know, I think we understand that, like, if we're going to achieve anything, we're going to be unbalanced. You know, we're not going to be the perfect dad, you know, husband, hobbyist at whatever, and worker all at the same times, as we talk about. I think it's
my case, friends. If I have any friends left that are listening, sorry that I only talk to Steve and Clay now.
Right. But that's what it is. We acknowledge that and we understand that. And I don't see it as sacrifices. It's just kind of choices.
But I think the question is not between balanced and imbalanced, because I totally agree. But it's like imbalanced versus being unhealthy.
So that unhealthy is going to depend on the person and their tolerance. So I'm going to use an example that is near and dear to the growth equation and to the Farewell podcast. So our wonderful colleague, Nate Meckler, is currently training to qualify for the Olympics in decathlon. And he is right there on the edge of going. And to go to the Olympics in that sport, you've got to be in the top 24 in the world. I've gotten a masterclass, Steve, in decathlon from Nate. So Nate, on the phone with me 2 weeks ago, said, like, his training's going great. Everything is clicking. He's currently, as of this recording, at a training camp with Damian Warner, prior guest of the podcast, reigning gold medalist at the Olympics in decathlon. I think he finished second or third at the most recent world championship. So, you know, clearly one of the best athletes on the planet, if not the best athlete on the planet. And what Nate told me is, everything's clicking, but I'm a little bit scared of one thing. And I'm paraphrasing. I said, well, what's the one thing, Nate? He's like, I'm starting to like dream about discus and think about discus the hour before I go to bed. And that's not good for me. And he learned that from Damian, who's the best in the world, who on this podcast said essentially the same thing, which, like, he loves the sport. And Damian, I believe, Clay, you interviewed him, so correct me if I'm wrong, but he said, like, kind of if he didn't learn this over time, he would just think about decathlon every day, all day, every waking hour, and dream about decathlon. But he's learned that he has to distract himself. That was his quote. He has to distract himself from decathlon. He didn't say it to be a healthier person. He said it to be a better decathlete. And I think that whether that is for an hour a day, for 2 hours a day, for 4 hours a day, that's going to be very different based on not only the person, but how old they are, who else is in their life, nature and nurture and situation all combining. But I do think you've got to have something in some amount of time for that distraction. And maybe what's hard for Caitlin Clark, to bring it back full circle, I believe in the piece she has a boyfriend, but when you're 18 to 22, generally speaking, you don't have kids. If you're a pro athlete or you're a name and likeness, you know, money-making athlete in college, you probably don't need to do too much else, and you're known for this thing. So it's very conducive at that age to like going all in. And, you know, we go back to LeBron, he came up at that age. And I think that once you have more complexity in your life, maybe it starts to tilt a little bit.
I just have a LeBron James story that actually sort of goes against what I was saying, but speaks directly to what you were talking about. So when the Cavs were playing the Golden State Warriors 2016 and game four, they lost 108-97 on their home court. So they were down 3-1. And if they were going to win, they would have to win three in a row and take two of those in Cleveland. And LeBron went home, and instead of watching film or going to bed, he watched Eddie Murphy stand up. He said this on a More Than an Athlete podcast, and he said, quote, "It was the best thing I could have done at that point in time. It got my mind off everything. I texted my teammates at the time we were watching on the group chat. I said, listen, I know the way y'all feeling right now. I know y'all feel like shit. I know we feel like we had this game tonight. I know none of us will get any sleep, but do me a favor, leave that shit in Cleveland. And when we board this flight to go to Golden State, if you all believe in me, then I'll make sure we get home for game six." They did. They won game five, they won game six, and they won game seven. And so that sort of speaks to it, right? LeBron was like in the moment when you might most expect him to be completely zoomed in and obsessed, he actually zoomed out.
That's a great quote. And I think maybe coming full circle, what sums up this segment of the conversation is it's not either or, it's both and. Like, you do have to make tons of sacrifices to be great and to get the best out of yourself at one or two things. And the minute that you are truly unidimensional, you are playing with fire, and it's only a matter of time before you get burned. And it's up to each person to figure out their temperament, their life circumstances, and to decide how close to the fire they can get before they get burned.
Yeah.
And for some people, for the young collegiate or aspiring Olympian that is single and doesn't have a family, it might be every waking hour but the last one. For the person that has more going on in their life, it might be 6 hours a day.
I want to give one quote from, I think, the most dominant athlete in the world right now, Ryan Crouser, 2-time Olympic champion in the shot put, has redefined the shot put. There's a wonderful article that came out recently. This is one of his friends or training partners talking, I believe. He says, "In my mind, if you think of an Olympic gold medalist, you think they're at some high performance facility with wires hooked up to them, like everything's dialed and studied. And he," meaning Ryan, "he's just a country boy who's got a boat, two boats actually, and a shot put ring with a gravel pit in his backyard. He's kind of low key about everything, gets his job done. Then it's time to play in the afternoons." I mean, I think, you know, to your degree, you know, to what you said, Brad, I think everyone's range and capacity differs, but there's always that like hint of like, hey, it's okay. I'm still kind of playing at this. I'm having something else in my life that is there for the sustainable greats, with obvious exceptions.
Yeah, because the minute that you get too fused with that thing, whether you're an athlete, a writer, a podcast host, doesn't matter what you are. The minute you get too fused with that thing and the fame, like, again, you're flying close to the sun. Maybe you get away with that for a week or two, but eventually you get burned. And we see it all the time. We'll see it this week. We'll see it next week. We'll see it until the end of time.
To go back to Steve's point about the teacher, I think that's really interesting because everything we're looking at this lens through competition and sport, and those things are so objective, and it's easy to see who's great because there are winners and losers and their records. And I do wonder, for someone who really wants to be like a great teacher, a great ER doctor, I'm just so curious how they, obviously we can't answer it now, or maybe you guys can, maybe you have friends we've talked to it about, but I can't answer it. I'm just curious how they think about greatness, right? Because it's probably, maybe that idea of greatness has more inherent balance built into it. I guess ER doctor and teacher, it's hard to be balanced because you're working all the time, but it's not so much about getting to the top. You know, it's like the measures are subjective and qualitative, not all of them, I guess, but in a way that I wonder if it changes the flavor and power of greatness.
For sure. And it's a societal values thing. I was just talking to one of Theo's friend's mom, who's a pediatric hospitalist, and she covers nights, seven nights a month. And we were joking. We're talking about Peter Attia's book, Outlive. And she's like, oh, I can't read that because I'm probably doing everything wrong. I'm like, what do you mean? You seem pretty healthy. She's like, no, I have to work seven nights a month. And every time I do it, it messes me up for 3 days. And you do the math, that means I messed up for 21 days a month. Well, that's a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not on a podcast with JJ Redick, but if your kid has, you know, what is it, RSV or an aneurysm, and you take your kid to the children's hospital at 2 a.m., you know who's keeping your kid alive? It's her.
Yeah.
And that's its own kind of greatness. And my guess is if you force LeBron to stay up every third night or whatever it is, every fourth night, all night, he'd be like, I'm not doing that sacrifice. So a lot of it is just like, where do we shine the light on greatness?
And I think, you know, to your point, Clay, I think what it does is because there's not like a, you know, a championship or a wins loss record or points, you know, scored tracking. What it does is it makes it more similar to like some people like LeBron or what we said earlier about Kobe, which is like the love of the thing is the real driver. The intrinsics, especially if we're talking about teacher, God knows no one's getting into teaching for awards, accolades, or money.
Right. They don't even get paid. But, at least the doctors get paid.
Like teachers don't get paid. But it, like, I'm going to brag on my wife here, but, you know, she's a elementary school teacher. She's been the, you know, teacher of the year, the specialist of the year. So I think she's great, but objectively she has some awards to show she's great too. But before she was a teacher, like she was an Olympic trials qualifier in running and represented the US at the World Half Marathon Championships. And you, if you ask her, which I have, we've talked about this, like the applying the thing, the motivation, whether it's to running or to teaching, is kind of the same in the sense that there's a little imbalance in like, hey, I want to be good at this. I'm going to get this done. You know, I'm going to do the things necessary to, you know, keep me whatever going in this in the direction that I want to go. So I think it's inherently there. I think the only difference, especially if you look at professions like teachers, is the intrinsic is even more shining through because there's no extrinsic or very little.
Every time I get an opportunity to drop the greatest quote from any novel ever, I do it. And it's the ending quote from Middlemarch by George Eliot, which is a book about a provincial town and all of these big personalities and many folks who are chasing their own version of fame. And the last phrase of the book is, "The growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts. And that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life in rest in unvisited tombs." I mean, I think that that just speaks to like, yeah, we should admire LeBron James and Caitlin Clark, and we should read this piece. And like a huge part of what makes life worth living is art. And I think that when you play as well as Caitlin Clark, you elevate sport to art. Like it makes you feel things, right? That's why we love it. And, you know, I'm not an economics professor, but like supply and demand and rarity, and you pay for things that are rare and elite athletes are really rare, and all that is fine. And we often just shine the light in like these places. And that's where we think about greatness when it's like, you know, Steve's wife and the ending quote of Middlemarch, like the teacher is making a lot of sacrifice too. We just don't necessarily compare that in the same way that we do to a LeBron James. And I think like, it's just, you gotta hold all these contradictions at once when you think about greatness on the world scale. And even when you think about getting the best out of yourself.
All right. Well, there you have it. There's a lot to unpack in there. I think the big lesson here is that there are many different ways to greatness. And as I said about the story that Wright wrote about Caitlin Clark, it raised more questions than it did gave answers. And I think that's the mark of a good story and hopefully also a great discussion. I also think one thing to say is like that maybe we didn't highlight explicitly, which we should, is that Caitlin is contending with all of these things. And this has been another incredible year for her, and like to have done this 4 years in a row now is pretty remarkable. And I know that I'm going to be glued to the TV as she goes through the rest of March Madness. Again, they're playing their second round game today. So if you guys want to check that out, you should. If you want to check out the story, it's on ESPN.com. And yeah, as always, we are eager to hear from you. We've gotten some good voicemails. So if you have thoughts about this show or anything else, if you want to give us your opinion on where we stand on greatness, how you think about greatness, maybe you're an ER doctor or a teacher, you can answer our question. Our voicemail is 646-893-9503. 646-893-9503. Brad wants to say something, but right before he does, I will continue to say that I will give $5 on Venmo to any question we use in the show. Go ahead, Brad.
And if you're still with us, we really appreciate you listening. The podcast is growing since we've relaunched as Farewell, in no small part thanks to Clay's just wonderful job making it so much better. The best way to grow a podcast is word of mouth. So if you enjoy the show, if you find it valuable, here's my ask. Pick your favorite episode and text message it to three people that you think would dig it. Three people, and tell them to listen, because it's extremely hard to break into someone's ears for a podcast. And the reason that Steve and I didn't ask you to do this for the last 3 years is we weren't proud of the show. We didn't think it was as good as it could be. Well, now we are. So we ask you to read our books because we think our books are great. Well, now we think this podcast is great. So if you enjoy it, pick your favorite episode, find three people, tell them to check out the show, and help us grow, because we want to be a signal amidst the noise, and we can't do that without your help.
Thank you, Brad. That was, I appreciate that. And I think it's totally right. I actually think a lot about how I listen to podcasts, how I get a new podcast, and it's always because someone recommends it. And if you hate the show, you don't have to do that. But if you do really like the show and you want to, that really would be helpful, and it would mean a lot to us. And you can also tell your friends they can make $5. They just ask a good question to our voicemail. So if that doesn't work, then I don't know what to tell you. But hope you guys enjoyed this. We're eager to hear from you. Please reach out via voicemail, email, clay.growtheq@gmail.com. And as always, take care of yourselves. We'll talk to you on the next episode of Farewell.